Welcome to Eye to Eye, the podcast of the Royal College of Ophthalmologists. My name is Sunil Mamtora, and I will be your host.
In this episode, I spoke with Hani Hassan, an ophthalmologist who works at the Great Western Hospital in Swindon. We spoke about his work related to predicting and identifying patients with hydroxychloroquine maculopathy.
Thank you very much, Hani, for joining me today to speak about your study regarding hydroxychloroquine toxicity and screening for this. Before we begin talking about the actual subject, I was wondering if you could just tell us a bit about the background of hydroxychloroquine and what it's used for.
Thank you, Sunil, for having me. Hydroxychloroquine is widely used by dermatologists and rheumatologists for the management of various conditions. And the largest amount of patients we have are actually patients with rheumatoid arthritis, Sjogren's syndrome, and SLE. You might have also noticed in the media recently the use of hydroxychloroquine for the treatment of the COVID-19 disease, which is not something confirmed yet, and there is a huge amount of debate about it. But it remains one of the most effective medications for the management of the common rheumatological conditions.
I understand it's quite low cost as well, is that right?
It is indeed, and I think that's why one of the reasons that makes it preferred by the prescribing doctors and also by the patients, not only in the UK and also worldwide. In other parts of the world, it's being used as an anti-malarial, anti-parasitic agent, and also very effective.
So is that chloroquine or is that hydroxychloroquine? And what's the difference between those two medications?
So it's the chemical structure. Both medications belong to the aminoquinolones group of medications. The more potent anti-malarial one is chloroquine, and it's also used for shorter durations for the treatment of malaria, for example. Hydroxychloroquine is the one that's used more by rheumatologists. It's more water soluble and it's easily absorbed from the intestine, and that what makes it a very potent anti-rheumatological factor.
So I mean, I think most ophthalmologists are aware of hydroxychloroquine and the fact that it can cause maculopathy. But how does hydroxychloroquine actually work, and how does it cause maculopathy?
Now, being a highly soluble agent, hydroxychloroquine actually binds to the peripheral tissues very strongly, and specifically to melanin. And binding of hydroxychloroquine to the melanin in the retinal pigment epithelium makes it reach a very high level and a toxic level, which in turn leads to the death of the RPE and the consequent death of the photoreceptors. Now, by understanding this pathological mechanism, it was noticed that the findings in the fundus autofluorescence depend on the stage of hydroxychloroquine toxicity. So early stages when the RPE is overloaded by hydroxychloroquine, it is showing signs of stress, it appears as a hyperfluorescent RPE. And in the later stages when the RPE has given up and started to die, it appears as a hypofluorescent RPE.
Okay, and what are the risk factors for developing maculopathy?
The largest known risk factor is the cumulative dose, Sunil. And classically, it is the 5 milligram per kg per day. And people who use this dose for more than 5 years have a prevalence of 7.5% of maculopathy. And this is actually a recent part of the evidence. Classically, it was thought that after 5 years of using hydroxychloroquine, the prevalence of maculopathy is only 1%. So the classical numbers were 1% after 5 years, 2% after 10 years, and 20% after 20 years. While the more recent data suggests that being on hydroxychloroquine for more than 5 years carries a higher risk. And being on it for more than 20 years carries as high as 50% chance of developing maculopathy. There are, of course, other risk factors like the use of tamoxifen, renal impairment, or low BMI. So smaller patients are actually are at more risk of developing maculopathy.
That's really interesting. So it seems as though you're saying that hydroxychloroquine maculopathy is much more prevalent than we thought.
Yes, it is actually. And we think, and that is also shown in the literature, that because of the advances in the technology of OCT and retinal imaging, we are now able to detect changes of hydroxychloroquine maculopathy at a much earlier stage compared to what used to happen in the past. And that's why we found that the prevalence is actually higher than it was thought to be.
So, I mean, my understanding is that hydroxychloroquine screening begins at 5 years. Is that correct?
So yes, patients who are only starting on hydroxychloroquine, they get a baseline test. They get a visual field test and an OCT. And then if the patient continues to take the medication for 5 years or more, then they need regular screening, which is annual. And then they need to have fundus autofluorescence, OCT and visual field on regular basis for as long as they stay on the hydroxychloroquine.
Okay, I mean, maybe we'll get into this a bit more later into the conversation, but, you know, with you saying that we're now able to detect hydroxychloroquine maculopathy earlier than previously, and that we're aware of the risk factors such as tamoxifen usage, renal dysfunction, and other patients' factors that may lead to the patient developing it earlier, do you think we should start screening earlier, or do you think 5 years is satisfactory?
Now, for the general cohort of patients, 5 years is the recommended starting date. But there are certain groups of patients where screening needs to start at a much earlier stage and needs to be more frequent. So, for example, patients, as I said, with renal failure, patients with other macular pathology like dry macular degeneration, that is to say patients who already have a weaker macula, they need to be tested at an earlier stage and they need to be tested more frequently. So some of them might require annual screening, even though they only started hydroxychloroquine for 1 or 2 years.
Sure, okay. So tell us about the current screening guidelines for hydroxychloroquine maculopathy.
So the in 2018, the Royal College published their guidelines for screening for hydroxychloroquine maculopathy. And here we need to differentiate between two things, retinal changes and macular changes. Hydroxychloroquine can cause both. But obviously the macular changes are the more significant ones because they result in permanent damage to the central field and a development of a permanent central scotoma, which of course has a higher impact on the patient's life. The screening guidelines recommend that all patients starting hydroxychloroquine, as I said, should have a baseline test, visual field and OCT and a fundus photograph. After 5 years, we repeat those tests, and if a patient has an abnormal result in one of the tests, that's considered as a possible maculopathy. Here, nothing needs to be done. We usually inform the patient's GP or rheumatologist that they have suspected maculopathy, and then we follow them annually. But the patient can remain on the hydroxychloroquine. Now, for patients who have abnormal results of two screening tests, that's considered as confirmed maculopathy, and those patients need to stop hydroxychloroquine. Now, Sunil, it's important to highlight that it is not the responsibility of the ophthalmologist to stop the hydroxychloroquine. Our responsibility is to communicate that to the GP or the treating rheumatologist, and then it's their role to stop hydroxychloroquine. So these are the current guidelines.
And you mentioned there that, you know, we do a 10-2 visual field in these patients. But, you know, what about 24-2 or 30-2? Is that sufficient to screen for maculopathy or not?
So as I have highlighted earlier, we need to differentiate between retinal changes and macular changes. So if we're looking at retinal changes, the more wider fields like the 24-2 and the 30-2, they have a role in detecting peripheral retinal changes. But if we want to look at the macula particularly, here we need to do the 10-2 field, and there are still many studies looking at the different patterns of maculopathy and retinopathy in different racial groups. So, for example, in people who have darker eyes, they have more melanin, they can have a different pattern of retinopathy, or they can develop peripheral field defects earlier than developing central field defects. So, for example, if we compare Asian and Caucasian patients, we can see a different pattern in the Asian patients with the peripheral retina affected, as well as the central retina. So each of these visual fields have a role to play in screening. But when we're talking about maculopathy particularly, it's the 10-2 that's specific to the macula.
Sure, I mean, I think it's quite a common clinical occurrence that when we're screening for patients in the clinic that we may ask for a 10-2 visual field and actually we get a 24-2. I think what you're saying really is that we probably should ask again for the 10-2 because it's, you know, going to give us a more higher resolution of the visual field of the patient we're doing the test on. Is that fair?
Yes, absolutely. When you do a 10-2, you are testing 64 or 68 points within the central 20 degrees of the vision or the fixation. So 10 degrees on either side of the fixation. So the total points you are testing are 68 points. While when you're doing a 24-2, this is more diluted. So you're not concentrating or focusing that much on the macula.
Brilliant. So now the interesting part, which I'm sure the listeners have all been waiting for, is your study. So tell us all about your study.
So in our study, we looked at the screening from an objective point of view. And we noticed that interpretation of the results of the visual field and the OCT requires a significant level of experience. And the other thing is that we needed to link the structure and the function to be able to detect maculopathy at a very early stage. So these are the two pillars of our study. Now, to avoid any subjectiveness in the interpretation of the test results, we tried to set cut-off points below which you can say that this OCT is abnormal or this visual field test is abnormal. And the part where we related the structure and the function, we developed a formula that links the volume of the outer nuclear layer, which is known to be one of the earliest layers to be affected by maculopathy. We linked that to the retinal threshold, and we divided the macula into 8 sectors based on the ETDRS study. So the same 8 sectors, the 6 millimeter circle, we used that to segment the macula into segments. And for each of those segments, we linked the structure, which is the OCT, into the function, which is the visual field. And then comes the role of the logistic regression. After doing the segmentation and the sectors, we have a set of continuous data. So you have retinal thresholds ranging from normal all the way to confirmed maculopathy, which is the bull's eye appearance. Also for the outer nuclear layer volume, you have normal volume, which goes down all the way to the other end of the spectrum, which is the bull's eye maculopathy. So logistic regression actually helps you to determine a cutoff point below which you would say this OCT is now abnormal and this visual field or the retinal threshold is abnormal. You can also use logistic regression in a more advanced way, which is called the multinomial logistic regression, to classify maculopathy into early, intermediate, or late. So that's going to be a later stage of the study.
And what did you find from the study?
By looking at the structure and function, we were able to find that the macular changes that happen in the volume of the outer nuclear layer and the reduction in sensitivity, when linked together, this leads to a much earlier detection of abnormality compared to the classical techniques. And this led us to the realization that the prevalence of toxicity after 5 years of use is actually higher than what's reported in literature. So as I said earlier, the recent data suggests that after 5 years of use of hydroxychloroquine, the prevalence of maculopathy is 7.5%, while in our cohort of patients, we found the prevalence is 15%, so double to what's reported in the literature. And we think that's because of two reasons, because we are detecting macular changes at a very early stage, and the other thing is that we are relating structure to function, and by that, we are able to eliminate any other pathology or any other confounding factors.
Okay, wow, I mean, 15%, that's 100% increase in the prevalence of hydroxychloroquine maculopathy compared to the existing literature, so a massive difference.
Indeed.
What's your plan going forward to look at that data further, or are you going to look at patients at at an earlier time point?
So now that, as you said, it's a significant jump in the prevalence, and it's rather a worrying finding. So to be able to have a solid result, we have established a partnership with Bristol University Hospital, and we have sent all of our patients, all of the patients whom we identified as having toxicity, we've sent them for electrodiagnostic testing. So all of those patients are now having multifocal ERG, and we are starting to get some of the results back, and they seem to be highly consistent with what we found.
So the multifocal ERG is objectively providing you with evidence that the patients you've suspected of having maculopathy actually do have changes and toxicity changes.
Yes, exactly. We are noticing two patterns of changes in the multifocal ERG. The first pattern is the generalized cone dysfunction, and the second pattern is a more focal cone dysfunction within the central 20 degrees of fixation, both of which are suggestive of hydroxychloroquine-related maculopathy.
Okay, that's really interesting. So in your study, were there any patients in whom you found it difficult to objectively diagnose toxicity in?
Yes, actually, we found it is actually challenging when it comes to extremes of axial length, because the shape of the retina changes slightly. So in high myopic patients, the posterior curvature of the eyeball is higher and the retina is generally thinner. So that makes it difficult to take in focus or sharply focused OCT. And it also makes it difficult to detect the outer nuclear layer because the retina in general is thinner. So for those patients, we had to do sort of a manual layering or segmentation of the retinal layers to be able to calculate the volume of the outer nuclear layer.
Okay, so you didn't exclude them from the study then?
We haven't excluded them because we managed to overcome the automated segmentation error by doing a manual segmentation error, a manual segmentation. Another group of patients, from the nature of rheumatological conditions, a majority of our patients are actually elderly, and most of them have RPE changes related to age-related maculopathy, age-related macular degeneration. So in those group of patients, again, the visual fields might have defects coming from the age-related macular changes rather than from the maculopathy from hydroxychloroquine. So that again was a challenging part. And that also applies to patients with DM or diabetic macular edema or epiretinal membrane and so on.
Sure. I mean, it sounds like you've got some fairly convincing and fairly significant results from your study. So based upon these findings, do you believe that there should be some changes to the Royal College guidelines for the screening for hydroxychloroquine maculopathy?
We certainly believe so. And from many discussions we had with other colleagues in some of the national and international conferences we've been to, we mainly wanted to focus on the objectivity of our study. So we wanted the results of the OCT and the visual field to be interpreted in an objective way. And I think that is one of the major take-home messages from our study. And that eliminates the confounding factor of experience. So not all of our patients get seen by retina specialists. Some of them are seen by general ophthalmologists, and some of them are seen by trainees, and with varying degrees of experience. Now, having an objective way to interpret the results is one of the important take-home messages. Now, another factor is to study the characteristics of the patients who are whom we identified as having toxicity. The durations of use, the BMI, their renal function, their retinal function. So all of those are, again, factors that need to be studied in depth for that specific group of patients. Mm. In the future, we believe looking into these data will help us find a protective mechanism. So if we know how the damage happens exactly, we can then develop a mechanism or a medication for that matter to protect the retinal pigment epithelium and the photoreceptors from the effect of hydroxychloroquine. But that will be something in the future.
Sure. So Once you identify a patient who you suspect has maculopathy or early changes, very early changes of maculopathy, so in this 15% group of your patients, what do you do next?
So as I said, we are actually following the guidelines of the Royal College when it comes to the further advice. So all of our patients whom we identified as having maculopathy, by definition, have abnormal results in two of the screening tests. So the next thing we have is to inform their GP or to inform their rheumatologist to either stop hydroxychloroquine or find an alternative. And we found very good cooperation from the rheumatologists in our in our hospital. The other thing I think is that actually very important to nail is the patients who have central field defects caused by hydroxychloroquine might not be eligible for driving. So informing the DVLA is another important factor. And again, our patients have been very sensible. Those who have established central field defects have all been in contact with the DVLA, and they are having further testing to show their suitability for driving and their safety for driving.
So one thing I was wondering is that, you know, when you've had such a higher than expected number of patients with hydroxychloroquine maculopathy, do you believe that in the future we'll see a reduced usage of hydroxychloroquine by our rheumatology colleagues as a result of the increase in prevalence of maculopathy?
Okay, so that's actually a difficult question to answer, because as we have said earlier in the podcast today, hydroxychloroquine is cheap, it's available, and it is highly effective for the treatment of the rheumatological conditions. Moreover, it was found that stopping hydroxychloroquine is associated with increased risk of mortality in patients with rheumatoid arthritis and SLE, for example. So it will be perfectly understandable that there will be some resistance for stopping hydroxychloroquine from the patient's point of view or from the rheumatologist's point of view. The important thing is to be able to detect those macular changes earlier, so that we can then advise the rheumatologist to discuss alternatives earlier, rather than leaving the situation where it's the point of no turn, when the patient has ended up by having a central scotoma or had to lose their independence or lose their driving license, for example. In the future, we hope that there are other alternatives available for the management of rheumatological conditions, and we believe by conducting further research, by selecting certain groups of patients who are at the highest risk, we can then stratify our patients and see who would benefit from continuing hydroxychloroquine with very close monitoring and who, for example, would benefit from stopping it altogether. So there needs to be more work to be done in this field to reach those conclusions.
Okay. So one final question. I mean, from the results of your study, it sounds that hydroxychloroquine maculopathy is a bigger problem than we first thought, and that hydroxychloroquine as a drug for the management of rheumatological conditions isn't going anywhere anytime soon, making hydroxychloroquine screening more important than ever. So what's your vision for the future of hydroxychloroquine toxicity screening?
That's a very good point. And I can relate to that by saying in our department, we have about 1,000 or 1,100 patients who are eligible for screening, because we have a very large catchment area. For the service to continue in the future, for the screening to continue, we need to implement virtual services, and we need to implement automation of the service. And we believe our study helps in those two areas, because the formulae and the algorithms we have developed allow for the service to be run on a virtual basis. So patients can come in for a visual field test, which takes a few minutes only, and an OCT scan, and they can go home. And in one session, in one clinical session, a clinician or a trained healthcare professional will be able to go through 30 test results, formulate a diagnosis, and print reports or letters to the GP and to the patient. So this is one thing, the virtual service. And the second thing is the automation of the service, and that will be another stage which we are working on to use our algorithm to develop a software that will be able to do the clinician part automatically and give the results there and then. So once the visual field test is done, you will get a report printed with it saying that this is normal or not. And once the OCT is done, again, you will get a report that says the result. That's something still under development, and we hope it will be out soon, and we hope it will be helpful in the development of this service.
Well, that sounds extremely exciting, and thank you so much for spending your time with me today.
Thank you very much, Sunil, and thank you for having me, and I wish everyone a good time to stay safe and stay protected from the COVID-19 disease, hopefully.
Well, that's the end of the episode, and I hope you enjoyed it. As always, we'd love to hear from you with any feedback, suggestions, or if you want to participate in the show. Send an email to communications@rcops.ac.uk. We have some great content lined up for the coming weeks and months and can't wait to share it with you. If you enjoyed the show, make sure to subscribe or leave a review.